Okay, well, this was going to be earlier in the day, but that's okay. We can reflect on risk and rumor. We've talked already a bit on detecting and managing concerns and rumors, but this is also tied in with some of the safety issues. Because at the end of the day, one of the things that we see globally, not just in our research, but if we look at other research, safety keeps coming up as the top issue. Sometimes it's decorated in other things, but at the end of the day, people's biggest concern is safety. So we'll talk a bit about that. So the first thing is just to think about what are some of the common concerns, which you're probably all familiar with. We're not going to get into too much details of AEFI management, adverse events following immunization. There are some pretty standard guidelines from WHO. But beyond the routine ways that you detect, investigate, and register any vaccine safety concerns, usually led from WHO, but collectively with the Ministry of Health and UN agencies, that's a pretty standard process. But where the kind of work we're doing in the room here is all the other stuff that doesn't happen in that official process. I think the thing that doesn't get captured in the typical official reporting and investigation of adverse events is this surrounding sea of informal communication. The thing that got me really interested, I've always been interested in rumors, particularly as they pertain to health, but I think the most dramatic lesson from history, as the International Monitoring Board of Polio calls it, was the polio, the rumors about polio vaccine sterilizing that were in northern Nigeria in 2003-2004 that led to a statewide boycott of the vaccine, reinfected over 20 countries, cost the global polio eradication program over $500 million, and has really set the program, made a lot more work moving forward. We're very lucky that boycott did not happen in the last few years, because then, although it was probably brewing, we didn't have the overt Boko Haram situation that we have now, which is another lesson, is while you have times of peace, do the best you can on your immunization, because it might not be so easy in a bit farther down. The Minister of Health, one of the Ministers of Health during this one-year boycott, was on my international advisory committee for the setting up of the Vaccine Confidence Project. And one of the things she said was, if we had only known what the potential impact of those rumors were, we would have acted more quickly. We had no idea those rumors were going around. There was never really an adverse event. It was rumors about sterilization. And so one of the things that we try to do, and I think in this group will be very important, particularly with the webinar and moving forward, are the case studies, because then you see a story. You see what happened after that, and how people managed it. So case studies and stories. So in the State of Vaccine Confidence 2015, one of the things we've developed is a Vaccine Confidence Index. It does not have the nuance and detail that some of the, like the social behavioral group is looking into, or some of the vaccine hesitancy measurements have. But this is just a global metric to kind of keep our finger on the pulse of the key issues, confidence levels in vaccine. But that came after a long process of looking at a lot of questions. And in the State of Vaccine Confidence, we did a lot of questioning with 5 countries. Georgia is in there also. We had the biggest sample of 12,000 people in Nigeria. But the kinds of categories of information, and I only put the Nigeria one up here because this is pretty consistent with what we hear in other countries: safety, effectiveness, bad previous experience that influenced the openness, other beliefs, which is another issue, because sometimes it's not about being against or questioning the vaccine, but there are other beliefs and approaches that people believe in more strongly. In Indonesia, there was someone promoting cupping, a kind of traditional healing method. In India, they have their traditional Ayurveda. In Europe, sometimes it's homeopathy. And people sometimes believe in that more than the vaccine. And sometimes it's not just an anti-feeling, but a believing in something else more strongly. So that's just something to keep in mind. And then convenience. I mean, the key areas of hesitancy are confidence or trust, the access issues around convenience, and then just don't feel like they need it or it doesn't work. So that's in more detail. But another lesson that we learned in all this, which you kind of know, but it always matters to have the data, when you looked at comparing India, Pakistan, UK, Nigeria, and Georgia with the questions that we ran, I was surprised to see that in that context, Nigeria looked like they were the least hesitant as a country. But when you... knowing what had happened in northern Nigeria, I thought something's funny here. So we did a subnational analysis, and then you see, when you average it all out, it's 8%. It's only 8% at that time, but it was one state, Kano State, where the highest number of refusers out of the hesitants. So basically, the subnational, the local data is really important. We've seen similar patterns in other countries. Again, I bring these examples up because they're examples of the sterilization rumor, which is probably the most common rumor, not just with vaccines, but around reproductive health interventions. It is a fundamental issue of survival. If you can't reproduce, if you're a marginalized group and you feel threatened, anything that might threaten your ability to reproduce is a deep anxiety and concern. There was one review of all the literature on sterilization rumors in the context of health only in Africa, and this out of 32 different studies about different kinds of sterilization rumors, 2/3 of them were about vaccines. The others were on anti-malaria pills, headaches, a few other things, but most of them were about vaccines. So we will not delete that rumor. That will keep recurring again and again. So that's one thing to have a plan to respond to. And the other thing we see is these rumors don't go away, particularly now with the internet. There was, in the 80s, tetanus rumors. This was even before social media. Rumors about the tetanus vaccine sterilizing went around the world, I think by fax or by phone or whatever. The report went out through the Catholic network, and WHO had to engage the Vatican to help resolve this. Now, this is not something that going through a typical adverse event channel with formal processes is going to resolve. You have to engage people outside of that. They finally got things back on track. Tetanus vaccine rates started to go up. 20 years later, Catholic bishops in Kenya felt excluded from a vaccine campaign, and started to get suspicious and went onto the internet, and they found these 20-year-old rumors. They didn't see them as rumors, they saw them as fact, and started again to revive these old rumors and totally disrupted the campaign. So one thing with with the context analysis is social media listening for current conversations. But the other thing is to keep aware of earlier histories, because they can come back, and they do come back. In that case, and I think one of the other things that helps in doing case studies is seeing what the impact was. I know in trying to get some attention to this in UNICEF a while ago, 15, 20 years ago, everybody wanted numbers. I saw a scientific article the other day that said, if you don't have the numbers, it's invisible to the policymakers, which I think we all know in this room, but it really does matter. But when they could see that when they banned the tetanus vaccine because of sterilization fears, the acceptance dropped to half. And we've seen that in HPV. We've seen that in other instances. And what's happening in the context of social media, it's happening much quicker and takes a lot longer to recover. We talked a bit with our Vietnam colleagues. There was the DTP, the pentavalent issues a while ago, but this was another example of a Twitter analysis, just watching what the issues were. In this case, we were trying to, we also gave some content of what's in there, not just the fact that there's more activity, but I think routinely, once you see there's a peak, you investigate. That relates more to the last session. This is pretty typical for any communications, finding out where the discussions are and where the influencers are. I had mentioned the Ghana analysis we did, looking at, what were the levers. Now, this looks like wallpaper up there right now, but it actually gives quite a bit of detail. But we're going to issues about things being secret, and as was mentioned earlier, that it would actually cause Ebola, and went to the parliament and the people. But can we turn the video on now? Okay. It's just a 10-minute video. I thought to bring a bit of the field into the meeting room.
The scourge from Ebola shows no signs of stopping.
The fear and mistrust took a violent turn in Liberia's capital, Monrovia. An angry crowd, many of them armed with clubs, raided an Ebola isolation ward in the city's largest slum.
It's a process that usually takes years, but in the race to beat the Ebola epidemic, doctors and scientists are speeding up efforts to create a vaccine against the virus in a matter of months.
The African countries cried out to the global community to come to the aid of Africa in fighting Ebola.
However, we'd never had a trial as sensitive a virus as the Ebola virus.
Because, mind you, we're coming from a backdrop where Ebola had killed between Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, had killed almost 11,000 people within that short space of time. So there was so much fear in the system.
It was meant to kill people. That was the news going around.
What were you going to use as the vaccine? Is it an Ebola vaccine or is it another vaccine? What is it? What is the component of the vaccine you're going to use?
People felt like this thing was being done undercover.
Why Ghana? Wouldn't it involve bringing a virus to Ghana before you start? They didn't know the difference between the virus and the vaccine. Do we have the systems? Do we even know how to register trials? Have people been paid a bribe to undertake these trials? Are these scientists taking us for a ride? Where is our regulator? All these questions were asked.
So the whole society was up in arms.
It wasn't a case of the laboratories or the ability to go about the test. It had to do with the issue of fear.
The media broke it as, guess what we've discovered? Here is this news about some clandestine vaccine trial in the Volta region.
Once the FDA began dealing with the protocols and the checks and balances, and having to speak to the center in Hohoi that was going to deal with it, it leaked, or it came out. Didn't leak, it came out. Once it was Ebola, it became an issue.
I had a call from an unknown person from the US. Then they said, there's going to be an Ebola vaccine trial in the Volta region of Ghana. There's a midwifery school there, and then some students have been selected for the trial.
No, we had not given approval yet. We had given conditional approval for preparation to start, and the preparation did not include the recruitment of subjects.
And the main fear was one person gets it, or there is a failure, then it is something that will spread. That is the feeling among the people.
TGIN needs to be highlighted in this trial. They were the first to issue a statement.
I'm a victim of vaccine injury. I wanted the government to listen. I saw from Star FM Online, a local radio station, reporting that a midwifery school in the Volta region is about to go through this exercise. I realized that if we go a bit diplomatic, nobody will listen. Ebola is no more just a disease, but a business. When I did the write-up, a strong group in the Volta region came out with a press release that they can't sit for the people to be used as guinea pigs. Actually, they just copy-paste some of the things that I wrote.
The political outfit of the ruling government, that's the NDC.
Yeah. In the Volta region.
In the Volta region. They issued a statement condemning it.
When we heard about the incentives, we heard about the trials, like I said again, we also had a lot of information from our brothers and sisters who come from the region and stays elsewhere in the diaspora. So we made a press release. People were not educated enough. Leadership for us in the region were not consulted properly. If they were dying, we might have lost people who were going to vote for us anyway, in the first place. And that was our agenda. Within 10 minutes, it was out there. We went to the social media, we went to radio, we went to print media. There was spontaneous response from Ghanaians.
A lot of people are confused. The youth are agitating and massing up for demonstration. Mr. Speaker, at this time of our country's development, we would not want to see social unrest due to negligence in educating the public.
About the 9th or 10th of June, there was a discussion on our national parliament that there were going to be trials in Ghana.
There was an initial allegation that the trial had already started in the Volta region without information to anybody. First, that was debunked. There were issues of bribery.
It is said that persons who volunteer for the exercise will be given 200 cedis and a mobile phone.
Mr. Speaker, MPs from the region have been mandated with phone calls from panic-stricken constituents who believe that this trial is aimed at spreading the dreaded Ebola disease in the Volta region. Systems that have been put in place to enable such research to be conducted in this country are not good enough.
Ghana Academy of Arts and Sciences are on our side. They have also raised concerns. Indeed, they met the minister on June 10th and raised 9 issues of concern.
The academy is not interested in making unnecessary waves. We saw a situation quietly, we resolve it, send a documentation to where it's needed to change or improve policy. That was what we thought we were doing.
GAS, their concerns were the seed. They had petitioned the minister, they had petitioned some other members of government.
Concerns were not addressed about the safety issues and a surrogate markers of immunity, of efficacy to whatever vaccine that you are going to develop.
The anger of the members of parliament, the anger with people from the Volta region was as a result of the fact that they felt they had a basis. And the basis was that it was scientists who were challenging the FDA.
The Ghana Academy of Arts and Sciences has the best scientists in our country. They are the people that have risen to the pinnacle of their profession. And if they are on the same side as Parliament, then Mr. Speaker, we are in good company.
At the time Parliament had its discussion on the 9th of June, a provisional approval had been given for one of the trials to start in the Volta region. On the floor of Parliament, there was a fiat that no trial of any Ebola vaccine can take place in Ghana.
We shouldn't suspend it. It should be stopped, not in Ghana here. It should be done somewhere else. If they want to do it in Ghana, they should do it in the laboratories with mice, rats, and chimpanzees, but not with human beings. We would urge the Minister for Health and all those responsible for admitting or permitting this trial to take place here to reconsider, not just to suspend it, but to say no, thank you.
The ministry has decided that the best thing to do is to suspend the trial. Tony Goodman admitted that the ministry failed to take the public through the necessary education, which would have eased their fears about the process.
To bring calm immediately to the situation, there was the immediate suspension of any further activity on it. Unfortunately, there were strict timelines that we had to meet, or that the company that was dealing with it had to meet. And by the time all that had been done through Parliament and through the checks and balances, the timelines had expired.
I appreciate that you're working in EPI programs and not necessarily in trials, but I just thought, as the principle of how these rumors can happen, and also sometimes when we introduce new vaccines, in the minds of the people, it is like a trial, and sometimes they call it trials. But the idea that, one, the rumor came from a diaspora source, from a Ghanaian in the U.S., and we've seen that in a number of situations. We've seen just in Europe, we have some very strong resistant groups in Poland against vaccines. And in the last 2 years, we've started to see a drop in vaccine acceptance in the Polish communities in Scotland and the UK, which are typically higher vaccinating. So the idea of diaspora, and this was not even with, I mean, we have a much more saturated social media environment, so these diaspora networks are important. Why Ghana? Why are you doing this here? We've seen that with introducing new vaccines. Like the HPV vaccine in Uzbekistan and in Armenia, Ghana, of the number of countries we were trialing this vaccine, we expected the least problems there, because Ghana typically is more trial aware, has been more stable politically, I mean, had a lot of elements that some of the other countries didn't have, but it went better in other countries. So sometimes you get these surprises. The other thing we tried to do in this short video is just get hearing different people's perspectives on it, because rumors are rarely one person against another. There's usually multiple perspectives. And often there's an element of truth or, I mean, one of the things they did think was that it was going to give us Ebola, and we are not stupid. We know to test a vaccine, you need to have people who have it and people who don't. But that means you need to give somebody Ebola, which they were partly right, but not right that there was going to be people infected. The Coalition for Independent Ghana, that's not a group that really has much to do with health, but it had a motive for leaping onto this disruptive environment. And that's one big thing that's happening in vaccination. You see these other groups that are not specifically health jumping on. So you need to keep your radar out for other groups with a motive to want to engage. Vaccines as a business, we hear that in EPI programs too, particularly for new vaccines. So just as an example of the way things can happen, when you have all the good information, you're set to go, and then you get a surprise, as we talked about earlier. So another point of this slide is that we often in public health look at risk from a strictly analytical, what's the effectiveness, what's the safety, you know, how it works, what's your disease burden, but don't look enough at risk as feelings and risk as politics. We saw both the politics and the feeling, the fear, the anger, the resent in the last video. Now, I don't think in the interest of time we've got time for breakout groups. If anyone has, if anyone has any relevant points from their countries, happy to. I think we've talked a bit about them earlier in the day, but don't hesitate to interrupt. So WHO has responding to rumors and crises work. There's a number of different. I know UNICEF also has different forms, and there are quite a few resources on responding to risk and rumor. But it's important to get fluent in them before you get hit with a rumor or this kind of situation, to be anticipating. Because what tends to happen is you get a crisis and you're flipping through all kinds of documents or going online to what should I do. But in that moment, you don't really have a lot of time. Rumors have been around for a long time. In the days where we didn't have the volume and scale and speed of social media, there were rumor clinics. Some of the first rumor clinics, this was in Boston. What they did was they listened for one rumor a week, and in the Sunday newspaper, they would counter it. So that was the pace of things. It'd be kind of helpful. I don't think in the current environment, a rumor clinic at this pace would really be much help. But just to put it in context, that rumors have been with us and will be with us for a long time. But we need new modes of responding to them. But I think one of the important things in this rumor clinic experience is the morale. They talk about rumors and how important they are to manage because they affect the morale of the population, which I think is an important thing we've seen. This was an older document we did when I was in UNICEF, but there's been a number of others done in the meanwhile, but I just bring it up because this particularly came out of the experience in dealing with the Nigeria rumors and the importance of engaging religious leaders, both in the India experience and in Nigeria, with the tetanus rumors, you know, engaging with the Vatican. In the UK, we've had to engage with certain imams, local leaders. And one thing we've also learned that, you know, you can go to the Vatican, but if you don't deal with your local religious leader, it's a different story. I know, for instance, one of the recurring rumors that has come up, or not rumors, this is a very specific and accurate concern, porcine, the use of porcine, which comes from a derivative from pork, is a gelatin. It's often used in some of the earlier polio vaccines in the capsules, but also in the nasal flu vaccine. It helps the vaccine stick to the nasal cavity. In the context of polio and the concerns from the Islamic community, WHO sat down with the head of the Organization of Islamic States, and there is an agreement that it's remote enough from pork and the pig, and it's in the interest of saving lives, that it's okay. Well, it's okay for most, but some local religious leaders don't agree with that. And we had that, we had to, with Pauline, investigate a situation in Yorkshire where there was one imam, the rest of them, no problem. So just because the guy at the top agrees, it doesn't mean that the local leaders, they have their own. Religious texts were written, pretty much all of them, before there were such things as vaccines. So religious resistance to vaccine is all about interpretation. So that can also mean that the local religious leader doesn't agree. This was, you've probably seen this before, this was the global study we did in 19, with 67 countries in 2016. We've done it with about 250,000 people around the world in 148 countries now, and we're going to be publishing that the beginning of next year. And you could see some trends and changes. This was just an article on the virality of misinformation, which I think we've been talking about already. Again, back to the rumor clinic idea, fake news was not invented by President Trump or Putin or anyone else. This has been around for a very long time. The term was used in the 1800s. So we're using different mediums to propagate it now, and it's moving much faster. But fake news is old and will continue. It will come in politically unstable times. But I think, to me, what is the most striking and sometimes shocking thing about the current environment is the gullibility of publics. The fact that people believe some of these rumors in wide-scale ways. And sometimes it's less obvious what's fact and what's fiction, but I think one of the objectives with managing these issues is to build the underlying confidence to the extent we can. We talked about the spread of these. This was just the tracking of HPV rumors and the impacts on multiple countries. This was an example from India. There were, I'm sure some of you are very familiar with it, WhatsApp, Facebook. What was interesting in that situation to me is it, and it's not unlike what happened in Indonesia, but I know the India situation particularly, it was a combination of capitalizing on a political situation where the prime minister has a very pro-nationalist Hindu stance and has made decisions that makes the Muslim community feel very threatened. So someone sent around a WhatsApp saying, Muslims, beware, you know everything the prime minister's done against us, these vaccines are gonna sterilize you or kill you or whatever. So it capitalized on a political environment. The other thing that we see happening, which I mentioned earlier, is the resurgence of kind of natural alternative therapies. So you've got one group saying, don't take those vaccines, they're not safe, they're going to kill you for political reason. And the natural healers saying, ah, this is an opportunity. I've got something else that'll work for you. So there's a lot of opportunism, political opportunism, there's business opportunism. I'm going to jump in with my product to sell, my herbal mix or my treatment, or it was cupping in Indonesia. So this perfect storm of different things swirling around. In this case, it took a lot of very local engagement, and I think you know what we heard from Uzbekistan this morning, the importance of the conversation, it cannot be understated. This is, again, pulling out the fact that safety and anxiety about risk is in study after study in both higher and low-income countries, is this was in Europe, and safety was way above all the other concerns. I just showed this. This is just Europe, but one of the advantages of going back and keeping measuring the same group with the same questions and same methods is that you can see changes. And the biggest thing that we learned is how quickly sentiment is changing. Typically, I remember we would have a KAP, Knowledge Attitudes Practice study, and you'd keep it on your shelf and refer to it for 5, sometimes 10 years. Sometimes it didn't even have a date on it. But now sentiment is like political opinion polling. So you need to keep listening. Just because you did that study last year doesn't mean it's relevant anymore. So that's, I think, being vigilant, being listening is not a one-off thing. It needs to be an ongoing part of your program. As I mentioned, Poland had the most dramatic drop in 2 years. And Poland is an example of a kind of perfect storm situation where you've got one country that is has a very aggressive, highly organized, embedded in the parliament movement and religious groups weighing in to challenge vaccine acceptance. It's influencing diaspora Polish communities. And in the meanwhile, because of conflict in Ukraine, there's a huge wave of migrants coming for short-term work from Ukraine to Poland. So Ukraine is the fountain of measles for Europe. 53,000 out of the 83,000 across all of Europe came from Ukraine and are still bubbling. So here you have source of a virus, a weakening confidence in vaccines that's spreading. And this is the phenomena that we increasingly need to look at. You need to look at your own country. You need to go local and understand local, but you need to also have your eyes out there and look at the landscape of where can influences come from. It's a lot to be listening and paying attention to, but it's really important. And you can't do it as an individual, but that's where, you know, in your teams, if people are keeping their eyes on different things together, you can kind of be alert to the landscape. One of the issues we've been focusing quite a bit on in along with HPV and a few other things in the last couple of years is the new dengue vaccine that was released in the two first countries were Brazil and the Philippines. And here's an example where two countries launched, they both had high dengue, both released the new vaccine. Absolute fury, the manufacturer announces a year after introduction that, oops, there's a risk that we actually, there was some suggestion that it was there, but had a lot more evidence, enough to announce that actually there's a small risk that this vaccine could cause a more serious kind of dengue disease if you have never been exposed to dengue before. In the Philippines, absolute chaos, panic, all kinds of knock-on effects. There's an article in your bag. The situation has been evolving. In Brazil, they relabeled, they trained their health workers, and got on with the program. So political context issues can totally have the same technical situation, but they can play out absolutely differently. I won't get into the details of what happened when, but it became a huge political, they were digging up bodies of children who had died of dengue, claiming that it was caused by the vaccine. It was really quite a dramatic situation. Everything from some of the same things we heard in the Ghana story, but this was an approved vaccine. This is the paper in your bag. We compared, we did the confidence index We had the 2016 data from the global study and went in, and this was the difference. In 2015, Philippines was one of the most confident countries in the world for their basic immunization. After the Dengvaxia saga, it went much more into the red. What's interesting to me that even the compatibility with religious beliefs went more negative. More people said, no, it was compatible with my religious beliefs before, but I've lost total trust. It's not even compatible with my religious beliefs anymore. Since then, we've gone back and done three waves of the index because they really, it was such a bad situation that they really invested a lot of work into building confidence, and so their index has gone up. But these things can change, but they take a lot of work. This was just one of the notices on the board. Again, like one of the things we've heard earlier, the knock-on effect on other vaccines, they have were refusing measles vaccines, other types of basic health interventions, because it wasn't even anymore about the vaccine. It was about they had totally lost trust in the health authorities to have approved and given 850,000 children this vaccine with a risk like that. That was the outrage that was going on. And so they said, that's it. And the trust building, interestingly, was not building trust in the dengue vaccine. All their efforts were about to build trust in the health authorities. And they used the opportunity of the measles outbreak to try to rebuild those relationships. There's a number of different approaches that they've done, but that was the focus. In a way, they didn't want to focus on the dengue vaccine because it was so volatile. So by focusing on the institutional relationships, this is just one of the effects. As I said, we went back with different waves of the confidence index, and they did start going back. Grace, we were going to break into groups now. You were proposing that people talk about how they would have dealt with this situation. I know there's a... Yeah, I mean, I can pull the slides, but I think we keep. Does anyone? We were going to say, what would you do in a situation like this? We've heard a little bit already this morning in relevant things, but if anyone has any additional comments from WHO side, I know WHO was very involved, UNICEF. Yeah, we were on a few calls together about this,
So what I was wondering is also perhaps if I can suggest as part of the coming discussion, the groups could consider preparedness for these kinds of events. So not what you do in the situation as they're emerging and taking place, but really the preparedness and planning and resilience dimensions. So that, you know, countries are thinking about, okay, these kinds of events, rumours, misinformation, adverse events are eventually inevitable in some form or another. So what are the ways in which programs can be as prepared as possible to respond, but also thinking about the activities that need to be implemented on an ongoing basis to eventually be able to mitigate or minimise the negative impact of these events when they do take place. And that's about, you know, this idea of resilience and having as much strength in the system and in people's trust and confidence in vaccination and people's understanding of the value and importance of vaccination, so that that level of you know, background knowledge and understanding really helps to ensure that people, you know, if they do encounter misinformation, that they ignore it and that they're kind of, in a sense, in epidemiological terms, inoculated against misinformation as well. So I think that could also be part of the discussion if there's space for that as well, just a suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's good. And, yeah, as I was mentioning earlier, getting familiar with the resources that are out there. But it's interesting, actually, we have three cases in the room, Ghana, Armenia, and Uzbekistan, who all had strong resilience, a good program, and still had these shocks to the system. So it's kind of a question of once getting things intact, but even then you need more. And what's that more about? What else? Shireen?
Yes. I just want to say something about the model we are using here. Yeah. If it is the behavior model. And by all means, you know, maybe from experience of those other countries, maybe there are risks in maybe implementing, maybe carry out a piloting or something. Then you anticipate the risk quickly, and you put in place measures, good communication system in place. You let people really understand the benefit of what is going on or what will take place vis-a-vis some of the threats to health risk, to healthcare. Or to health. And quickly, since you are going to anticipate that, you know there is a risk you have to communicate. There is a risk on which you have to work. Then you put in activities to be able to work out. You inform people about the benefit. People want to see the benefit vis-a-vis the threat. But then, if you don't do anything and you carry out, you'll be surprised that the unexpected will happen.
Yeah.
Okay, I want my colleague to.
Okay, I just want to share experience. In fact, I thought we were going to discuss the, how do you put it? Yes, the malaria documentation that you showed. I mean, sorry, the Ebola.
Ebola, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's me sitting at a probably just behind the EPI manager. When we go to forums like this, we find it interesting sometimes because you think that you've done everything right. So, for example, based on the Ebola scare, I mean the vaccine scare, what we're introducing before we introduce a malaria vaccine. We went through the learning process. We engaged Parliament. We engaged the scientific group, the so-called Ghana Academy of Sciences and so on, and the communities and everything. So we thought we had learned enough from the Ebola. Yet, just a week before, we had just one post from a WhatsApp, and everything was negated. We had gone through all the processes. Parliament had agreed. We had engaged the arts and sciences. They had issued their comments. We had responded. We had engaged the media. So the point I'm making is that the situations differ. Every time people find something else to, you know, derange the vaccine. So you will still go through the process. And yet something unexpected comes, and you need to respond. So for me, I think that is more of the crisis communication group or the crisis communication bit of the planning that should be strengthened because at each stage, you go through something else. So from before the Ebola, what could they have done? Normally when they are doing trials, you don't engage people. Trials are normally done on the side. So you don't go to the, it's not even allowed by law. If you are doing a trial, by law, you cannot go and engage people, especially at the national level. It's only at the community level that you do that. But because of this, I am sure that when they are going to do a big scale trial, they probably would have to engage Parliament and all that. And based on the lessons we learned, because we were doing a pilot introduction, which was more or less a miniature new vaccine introduction, we went through the process. Yet it was accepted by all the people involved. Meanwhile, only one person was able to derange. And I was just looking at the data. We have plateaued. We've never been able to go beyond 70%. Meanwhile, traditionally, our coverages are 95% and above. But for RTSS, we are unable to even move above 70%. That's my.
Thank you, Heidi. That was really, really interesting, really interesting case studies. I found two particular things really interesting. The first one is the rumor clinic in the U.S. And the reason why I found that was so interesting is because although it would never work today for obvious reasons, there was a centralized place that people knew where to go for their concerns. And people knew that they could, you know, voice their concerns to this place and they would get a response. And I think that's a really interesting lesson for us to learn, is that where do people go when they have a rumor? Is there a centralized place? Is it the Ministry of Health? Is it the National Institute of Immunization? Where do they go? And if there is a vacuum or they don't know where to go, they will go to the chat rooms or they will go to Google or they will go to other areas. So I thought that was really, really interesting. Yeah. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, and as we were, you know, as we were looking at the Ebola case study, you just, you know, it's like a disaster unfolding before your eyes. And you even said it yourself, Heidi, that there was some truth to their concerns, but they got it wrong. Yeah. And I'm also reminded of things that we did in polio, where there were these really, really severe rumors that the polio program was, you know, colluding with the CIA or that it was a part of a secret service. And for years and years, we said, no, that's crazy. There's no way that that is possible. And then the worst happened. And, you know, A, you lose all credibility, of course, and it's very difficult to recover. But to me, the lesson from both of these is that there is always an ounce of truth in the rumors, or there is usually an ounce of truth. And I think the key to building trust is finding that little iota of truth and explaining and balancing and nuancing your response. Because I think when you say there's nothing, there's no validity to these rumors, you lose 90% of the people that you're trying to reach. So I thought those were just two really interesting lessons from what you said. Thank you.
Thanks.
You just made a very interesting comment. And regarding to having a place where we can you know, where all the rumors can be addressed. That was one of the reasons why I was thinking a dedicated, you know, Facebook or Telegram or WhatsApp, whatever group, where all these rumors can be actually discussed and answered by somebody reputable. Maybe that's effective. I'm not sure. I don't have an answer to that, but that's what I'm thinking about. And because I also think that if you have a vacuum and you don't have a single reputable source, then people will indeed go to the chat rooms, and that's what has been happening. So maybe we need to think how to create that single, source of information and make sure that it's credible to such an extent that people actually go there and listen to them, not to the chat rooms. But also, while listening to your presentation, I was thinking of a couple of things, including one of the things you mentioned that people take opportunities of the crisis, yeah, and different all sorts of groups engage in this crisis. So I just wanted to share an experience from Uzbekistan, again with the HPV. The debate became so widespread, and pretty much every single person was talking about HPV to such an extent that there was a human rights NGO that got involved, and basically the question they raised is whether or not this vaccine is mandatory. And so it is, in fact, a part of the national immunization calendar, so technically it is mandatory. So the human rights NGO said, no, this is wrong. You know, you cannot force us to have a vaccine if we don't want it. So instead of going to the Ministry of Health, this NGO organized some kind of side event somewhere. We don't know anything about it. And they made a video about it on the social media, on Facebook. And so it became very popular. Then one of our social media influencers made a positive post on HPV. So she joined the debate on that post and was very argumentative about how this is a violation of human rights. You know, so luckily we saw it. And we actually invited her to WHO office with the Ministry of Health colleagues, you know, and so everybody actually sat down and spoke to her. She came with an army of other people. And in the end of the discussion, she was actually supportive, but in no way she further engaged in the debate. So she didn't counter her previous comments. She just kind of disappeared from the debate. But a positive outcome of this was that one of the people she brought in was a person from the ecological party. Hmm. Why ecological party? I don't know how that's related to HPV, but this person was actually so convinced by our arguments that she went to all of our further events afterwards and actually supported the HPV vaccine. So indeed, everyone who can gets involved in this debate. And it can be a positive and negative. But again, in our face-to-face interaction, it made positive influence in the end. And yes, what you just mentioned, the crisis communication plan or strategy, it really has to be strengthened, because I think even with the case of Uzbekistan, we knew that things will happen. You know, we originally knew, because we had the formative research, it showed negative views. So we knew that people are not super excited about the vaccine, you know. But I think until the last moment, we didn't really fully understand how these rumors on the social media, how influential they can be. Even when it was all happening already on the Facebook, in the Facebook groups, I think both MOH, WHO, UNICEF, none of us really took it seriously to the extent that it should have been taken, you know. So we acted, and we had a communication plan, and we did all the, you know, all the activities that we had prepared. But with this specific, you know, eruption of myths in Facebook, we took action, I think, too late, you know. So my piece of advice to colleagues who are planning to introduce, take it really seriously. You know, this will happen most likely, and I don't know what the best approach is to dealing with Facebook and social media reaction, but it really needs to be a part of the plan. It really needs to be addressed in advance, because when it happens, you come up with all sorts of ideas, but it's crazy. So we really need to be prepared for that and take it very, very seriously.
Thanks. I mean, I think that this reinforces, I was thinking also in Armenia, I read very carefully through the Gavi, we talked about this, the Gavi application, and Armenia had written one of the best summaries of the situation I had seen, that said, under the, you know, anticipating risk, you know, X country, Y country, this, you know, listed all these countries that had had challenges or had to suspend their HPV program for X, Y, or Z reason, and the fact that we are aware that all this information is circulating on our local, this will be our biggest challenge. So it was a lot of consciousness about it, and I think in Ghana, in Armenia, in Uzbekistan, and in the Philippines, actually, you know, even the confidence was very high before. Things happen, and I think it's how do you, on top of all the other normally important things to do, what else do you need to do to be prepared? I think one thing is the challenge with taking it seriously is that sometimes there's so much noise out there, it is hard to know what will be, but I think you need to visualize what the knock-on effect. And one of the reasons that we're trying to do more case studies is that so people can see what the impact is. It's one thing if you have a guideline or a do this and then this, but it's very different when you have a story that shows, okay, this didn't seem like much, but this is what happened. You know, we want to make a case study with Armenia, with Uzbekistan, with Ghana, and others to say, okay, when we've done all the stuff we are supposed to do, the good news is if you hadn't done that, it would have been even worse. So don't feel like you what you've done has been a loss, because it could have been, you know, without that. I do think one of the comments that Shireen made also about, you know, the small bit of information, I mean, the small truth to some of the rumors is a big issue with safety. Because we've been, one thing that I hear a lot is, you know, you people have been telling us it's 100% effective, and, you know, you've been telling us this for so long, we know better now. I don't think people have actually said 100%. They've probably said it's good enough. But anyway, what people heard, which is what we have to pay attention to, is that it felt like they were told it was 100% effective. Already, if you say, you're right, it's not 100% effective, there's a small risk, and that totally changes the conversation, because they feel like, oh, you know, you're willing to talk about the fact that there are some risks. It does change the dynamic. So I think that's something in there. I'm going to talk. Oh, great. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, if I may ask a related question, less to do with the Ebola example, and perhaps more broad to events that can call into question the public's confidence with immunization. Laos spent a lot of time building and reestablishing and strengthening governance mechanisms like the NITAG and the AEFI committee. And I'm curious from the other countries, as you're responding to these events, how have these kinds of bodies, specifically NITAG or AEFI or something else that you might leverage, how have you used them in forming or supporting your response? Because I would expect that they play an important role, but I haven't necessarily heard them mentioned explicitly in these discussions. So I'd appreciate any perspectives from other countries and how you've used these resources. Thank you.
I think I have add more and one question and from Vietnam. Maybe can share more experience for us, because I heard that for the Facebook, back to the media, the Facebook and almost the community know sometimes have the AEFI case. See, the community, they know quickly more than the more health worker. Even the health worker doesn't know about the information. But how the community, maybe we have to learn more from you.
Thank you for your questions. As you know, we use Facebook in order to give positive information for the community and the parent, and nearly have and prepare the question and answer, always answer all the questions from mother. And as I said, about the information about the causality of AEFI, we not inform on the Facebook. No, only inform in on mass media. We call to the some representative of mass media, attend the meeting, and inform them about the causality assessment. And sometimes we have to answer directly some questions. And Facebook never informs the result of causality of assessment of the AEFI. Yeah, only the answers all questions with the mother and inform. And we actively inform the positive information. For example, vaccine safety, the high coverage, and the necessary to receive the full immunization, and all the questions from mother and the community. Yeah.
Do any of the other countries have some comments on the value and role of the NITAG or AEFI system? That's what you were trying to understand, yeah.
In Armenia, we tried to use resources of NITAG to speak on TV, to announce that decision, for example, HPV vaccine age expansion is a decision of NITAG, and NITAG come to that decision. Head of NITAG speaks several times. Press releases we organize on this issue, and head of NITAG talk how NITAG is functioning, how this decision was made, answered questions she met with journalists, answered questions, several messages we spread on NITAG meeting, and how this decision was made. I think it's really worked that time, and people, especially those who are academicians, they were aware that decision was evidence-based, and decision was not like MOH was made, and that is only ministers' willingness to expand age, HPV vaccination age. This is based on really documents, WHO position paper, some countries' experience, well studied, and finally country decided to that decision.
Thank you. So I will talk more of the committee, the AEFI committee, because I am one of the focal points. Yes, we have a very strong pharmacovigilance system. We have AEFI committee, and we have both causality assessment. We call them technical advisory committee. It's actually based in at the Food and Drugs Authority. And because the EPI has structures up to the community level, I would say that the system, the FDA system rather, works through EPI. So they collect the data and send through the national level, but ultimately it's the Food and Drugs Authority that convenes the meetings which we participate. And so we work with them and develop frequently asked questions and all that, especially when there are issues of death, for example, is a committee that really responds. Because as far as we are concerned, we don't have any, as the MOH has no credibility to lose, because the public confidence is almost always low when it comes to the Ministry of Health or the Ghana Health Service. So most of the things are left for the other organizations to talk about. So we normally will not respond, but rather the third party responds on behalf of Ministry of Health. But of course, we are the background, so we know exactly what they will do. Well, we give them the information and we help them to address those things and the rumors on our behalf. We have just recently constituted the NITAC, so there hasn't been any real formal engagement between NITAC and the public. So we still are in the very infantile stage of NITAC. We've just had one meeting. But of course, the ministry also serves as secretariat for the NITAC. So we hope that eventually they will take over, especially in preparations for making a case for new vaccine introductions. The NITAC that will take over now. And that would absolve the Ministry of Health from playing the dual role of referee and player at the same time. So that NITAC takes care of those things. So basically that's what I can say for now.
I think that's an important point about the separation of the decision making and then the implementation. It helps.
Well, basically, like in Armenia, NITAC has been involved in all of the processes. You know, like I told you, we activated the crisis communication plan, which means basically everybody engaged in the immunization process and all the partners, they were all engaged. So the head of NITAC was on TV shows. She was giving interviews, and other members were giving interviews on the regional level. It was all on TV, live TV shows, radio shows. You know, all the members basically were engaged. Then we had partnerships with the Republican Oncological Center, then the Republican Microbiology Center. The gynecological center, so all of the top, you know, relevant government institutions were engaged, and all the heads of these institutions, they were on TV, radio, you know, constantly answering questions. So that's why I'm saying, you know, this happened when already rumors got out of control, basically, you know. So if you can plan ahead and prepare for this and somehow prevent this kind of stuff, it would be more effective, because we engaged everyone and it helped and we have a good result of the program. But like I said, it was a very difficult process.
So I just want to ask a question. You said in Uzbekistan you activated the crisis communication plan. Was that something that was already in place as all this was going on? Was that something you had to quickly develop in response to these rumors? And also I wanted to ask that question to other countries as well. Is around a new vaccine introduction or around, you know, a vaccine trial pilot, is there in place a crisis communication plan?
Yeah, so basically with WHO, this year we both had a formative research on HPV, which was followed up with a HPV communication plan, which is the standard plan that we implemented for 2 months, basically. And at the same time, parallel to this, around March, we also had a crisis communication a workshop. That was not just for HPV, that was for the whole immunization program. And the result of that workshop was also crisis communication strategy with an addendum of key messages specifically on HPV. And these key messages, they have been used throughout all of our print materials, you know, all types of communication. Then we also used WHO Q&As, which ended up... So basically what happened was that We made a very short brochures with Q&As, but it turned out not to be enough. So we had to make an expanded version of these Q&As because people needed so much additional information. You know, a little bit of information was not enough. We had to provide everything from where the vaccine came from, when it was, you know, developed, when it was tested, where it was tested, everything. All sorts of information. Sorry, that's a different point. But yeah, we had a crisis communication plan developed in parallel during this year.
In Georgia, we widely use ICC and NITAG recommendations. ICC make more practical recommendations for the immunization program for introducing vaccine. For example, we decision that we introduce HPV vaccination demo project in Georgia was made by the ICC. Also, we use NITAG recommendations, more scientific recommendations from that. And last decision is under the Ministry of Health. The communication strategy also is the under the Ministry of Health with help with the National Center of Disease Control. Also, when we have a general crisis management general plan under the communication strategy, and in particular concrete situations, we make more concrete plans, crisis plans, and. And act under these concrete plans. Thanks.
Okay. I'm just going to end with there's a new characterization of a safety event in WHO in the Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety. It's been an issue that has been going on but hasn't really made it into the list of technical adverse events, and it's these psychosomatic reactions, what has been historically called psychosomatic reactions to vaccines in general. So we've seen this phenomena. Some of you may have seen it in different countries, but around the world, we've seen episodes. There was in Pakistan, there was an example of somebody sending a WhatsApp of a few boys fainting after polio vaccine with the rumor that it was poisoning, created kind of mass chaos. In Tamil Nadu, it was a similar thing with the MR vaccine, girls were fainting, and kind of mobility issues and para paralysis, not real, I mean, real symptoms, but a different cause. There's been a whole series of large groups of girls having these reactions in Japan, in Denmark, in the Netherlands. And in Colombia, 600 girls across multiple settings. This creates a lot of anxiety. It makes politicians concerned. People don't really know how to react to it. And the worst thing you can tell people who are having pain, who are having distress, is don't worry, it's just psychosomatic, or just it's been a real problem. It's kind of aggravated the situation. One of the things we see is a mimic behavior on YouTube. We haven't talked much about YouTube, but YouTube is becoming a viral. It's very emotive, more than text. It's visual. You have short videos, and it has a different kind of contagion effect.
This is in Ireland. This is a group of girls who are claiming, who are complaining about the effect, and she's telling the Minister of Health, how dare you continue with this HPV program? Look at us. How dare you even come up and talk to us? In Colombia, girls lined up in a video called Gardasil Did It, and in the background is a Bob Dylan-like guitar player about his sister he lost to, thought he lost to HPV. In Denmark, all these are movements of girls who are mimicking. I mean, it's almost the way the girls have lined up in these different videos, and there's some in Japan, they see another one. And this is a new phenomena that, and it's not just about HPV, because the polio rumor in Pakistan, it was boys kind of lining up almost exactly like this, but they were, in those cases, they were clearly faked fainting. But it created total disruption in the program. These have impacts. They destabilize politicians. I mean, the Ministry of Health in Japan that suspended their proactive recommendation of HPV 6.5 years ago. I sit with the Ministry of Health at least once a year, sometimes twice, to talk through. And what I've been told is we know there's no scientific basis for this. We are paralyzed by the politics. We are afraid of the emotions. Where we need your help is managing public emotions. We don't know how to do it. They don't want to go out the door. In Colombia, the president of the country made a statement saying, you know, don't worry, we found this was psychosomatic. The Minister of Health went to talk with the community. When he landed, the army had to hold back the angry community because they had heard this was not real. Now, one of the messages here, and it gets back to the comment of there's a grain of truth, these are real symptoms. These are not made-up symptoms, but they're not because of the contents of the vaccine. They are about the vaccination experience. And after a lot of discussion and debate with GACS, the Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety, at first they had characterized it as anxiety-related, but have since renamed it to be, it actually is characterized in the books, immunization stress-related responses. Now, the concern about characterizing it like this makes it look like, I mean, the concern from the public health side is, well, this is making it look like it's related to the vaccine. The reality is it's related to the vaccination experience, underlying anxieties, stress, that may not, you know, your vulnerability to these kind of reactions often depends on, you know, your own fragile nature, but at any rate, this is borrowed from Madhava, who works in the program. But now the good thing is it's been characterized. There's a draft manual that's going to be coming out on how do you deal with kind of policymakers, how do you deal with publics, because the part of the challenge with this has been, you know, people didn't know how to handle it. What do I do next? How do I handle this? The most important thing is not to start with, which is the first instinct, it's not related to the vaccine. The first reaction should be, I'm sorry you're going through this pain. We want to think about what we can do to make your daughter feel better. By starting with our instinct, which is to get defensive about the vaccine, we already lose some of these parents and sometimes make them far more angry. These are real symptoms. Many of these girls have had chronic pain. They have eating disorders. They're fainting. And it's not just girls. I got an angry letter from one mother who said, this isn't just about girls. There are boys who have these too. This is an awful... they are real. And I think that It's very challenging. We are starting a collaboration with King's College, the Institute of Psychiatry. They're kind of quite well known for their work on psychosomatic illness, particularly this phenomena. We're also looking at the role of social media in provoking these symptoms, because typically these kind of symptoms happen when you're in a group and you see one girl faint and then you get scared and it's like dominoes. But with social media now, we're seeing that you can see it happen on YouTube halfway around the world and you get moved by it and you start fainting. So it's a whole new landscape, and there are a group of psychiatrists and others working on how do we get a better handle on this, how do we mitigate this. There's one example where all the social media was turned off, everybody got better. But can you do that? I mean, that's where we have to figure out. Facebook itself, internally, in their own research group, has kind of changed what goes out and sees the fact that if certain things are changed in the narrative, in the presentation, it changes the reaction, and you can either trigger or calm these emotions. And one of the areas we're looking more at is in this domain of these non-specific but very real reactions to the experience of vaccination. What can we do to prevent it or mitigate it? Getting back to what Lisa was saying about resilience, everything we can do to make the vaccination experience comfortable, reassuring, accepting, calming, and not making girls feel like their numbers lined up in a, you know, or parents with children, or, and it gets also back to the power of face-to-face conversation, which I think in this current environment of a lot of, you know, social media and other things where you hear things and it's not even about someone you've talked to, you quote, trust sources that people you've never met. And I think that getting that kind of empathy back into that conversation, doing what you can to make that experience, this isn't just about the vaccine, it's about the vaccination and the immunization, I mean, that experience. So I think on that note, we're on time here, but that just to stay with that thought as part of our interventions to make that context the best possible and supportive we can. Thank you.